In this Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast for September 2023, we hear Professor Francis Campbell, Vice-Chancellor, University of Notre Dame, Australia, whose talk is entitled, Wise as Serpents, Innocent as Doves, Navigating a Broken World with a Catholic Purpose. It's introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody, who will also moderate the Q&A.
So today we've got second appearance, and I'm very grateful to him, both on account of his distinction and on account of the fact that he's taken time out from a busy period in Sydney in his role as Vice-Chancellor of the University of Notre Dame, Francis Campbell. He's talking to us today, wise as serpents, innocent as doves, which I thought was very poetic, but he tells me it comes from St. Matthew's Gospel. But that goes without saying, therefore, doesn't it? And he's saying, navigating a broken world with a Catholic purpose. Francis is an Irishman, as you'll soon tell by the way he talks, who worked in the British colonial service, British diplomatic service, rather, for a long time, including a very distinguished stint in the Vatican. So, Francis, could I welcome you to the podium and say how grateful I am for your distinction and your willingness to talk to the Society, and also for the, based on last year's presentation, the excellence of your thought and clarity of purpose, which it demonstrated. So, welcome again.
Thank you, Jack, for your very kind words of welcome, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to be back amongst you and to see, you know, as we sort of move into those post-COVID years, even though it's still circulating in our community, fora such as these gathering and increasing numbers coming out, because I think it is pertinent to some of the words that I will say later in the text about community and the importance of community. Now, Jack has posed me with a difficult and somewhat challenging title this afternoon, Wise as Serpents, Innocent as Doves, Navigating a Broken World with a Catholic Purpose. Now, it comes from Matthew's Gospel 10:16, and it's in the context, and I think it's always important to put the quote or the title in the context. It's in the context of Jesus' mission to the 12. He opens on 10:16 saying, "See, I am sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be as wise as serpents and innocent as doves." If I go further on down around 10:23, and this will be pertinent to the end and my concluding comments, he finishes this section by saying, "But the one who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. For truly I tell you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes." So, distinguished ladies and gentlemen of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, it's really a delight to be back with you this year and to build on what I addressed last year. Last year we spoke about a place of faith in the public square. That text dealt more with the theoretical underpinnings of a pluralist society and the place of faith in the public square that came about over recent centuries. For ease of reference, I will shortly summarise the pertinent points from that text before moving to the scope of this afternoon's talk, which focuses more on the how. But firstly, the why. Why should faith be in the public square? What right does it have to be there? How is that consistent with contemporary notions of democracy, secularism, pluralism, etc.? For me, and on the basis of what I read and on the basis of my own experience, societies function more easily when there is a healthy plurality providing space for multiple identities to exist, contribute, and flourish. Such societies find it easier to deal with ever more complex worlds of difference rather than simply trying to sideline difference, or perhaps worse still, impose a false and dull uniformity. Faith, for me, is part of that difference, and that means that society is exploring the question of what role faith plays or should play in the wider society is paramount. Such questions, though, are rarely definitively settled, and it can come down to either a religious state, an excessively secular one, or, where the Western world mostly sits, somewhere along that spectrum. Now, last year we looked at that spectrum and the philosophical underpinnings and the differences between the various traditions from the Enlightenments of 1776 and that of 1789, and the more gradualist evolution within the then British Empire and its constituent parts. In essence, within the West, there is no uniformity about the place of faith in the society. This results in society still struggling with questions of faith and how it aids or hinders cohesion and the national question and issues of governance. Recently, diversity of faiths within particular contexts and diversity of beliefs provides additional complexities for all of us to navigate. So it's back to that choice and spectrum. Theocracy, militant secularism at either ends of the spectrum, and a place somewhere in between. But what is that in between? And so we hear vibrant debates going all around us, which would suggest that sometimes the solution can only be found in creating more privatised forms of religion, to push religion out of the public square and into the private sphere. The view going that competing absolutist claims by faiths must be rejected and replaced with something which has a claim to be neutral, fair, objective, non-discriminatory. But ladies and gentlemen, as we saw last year, that claim of neutrality and objectivity still comes from a very particular belief on that spectrum, from theocracy to militant secularism. So for governments or regulators, sometimes the easiest solution might be to pick the neutral and get faith or particularity out of the public context. That rush to a neutral uniformity carries with it significant risks way beyond the concerns of religious communities alone. Why? Because if religious difference is excluded simply because it challenges or demands us to navigate complexities, then surely other differences or traditions will pose that same challenge, that same need to find a solution for complex questions of society's cohesion. We can see efforts in the past. One can think of the years post-1789 and Robespierre, or one can think of the years post-1917, where different systems, new ideologies, tried to impose a new set of neutral values and to impose them on a national society and culture, and thereby create a rupture. And within that rupture, hundreds of thousands and millions of people lost their lives or their liberty was denied. And the challenge is there too for faith groups grappling with a changed and broken world. What do? Retreat? Be tempted to become a desert people, pure but distant from the world? Or do they retreat from promoting the very distinctiveness of the offer in education or health to blend in? The inconvenient becomes optional, perhaps. But as a colleague, Professor Eamon Conway, describes with Catholic Identity in Education, if it's optional today, then it is just one small step tomorrow to being irrelevant. Pope Francis, speaking in 2014, saw that risk. In talking about education, he said it cannot be neutral. It's either positive or negative. Either it enriches or it impoverishes. Either it enables a person to grow or it lessens, even corrupts him. The mission of schools is to develop a sense of truth, he said, of what is good and beautiful. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, that instinct or temptation to blend in the face of challenge or complexity erodes something distinctive and indeed our very raison d'etre for a separate and distinctive offering to society in the first place. Now, in the title that Jack posed, the words used are a broken world. Is our world broken? That's an impossible question to answer, even if you gave me all the time this afternoon. Because I could give you a litany of what's wrong in our world and go over region by region, from Ukraine to the growing tensions in the South China Sea, or examine the state of the global economy or assess the impact of climate change. And yet we could point to advances in health, wealth, fewer people dying globally than in the past centuries from war. We could think about the choices we now have, which previous generations did not enjoy when decision-making was left to a smaller and more restricted group in our society. And yet we have some looming questions, even in parts of the world where until recently we assumed the big questions of the day might have been settled. We see democracy increasing under increasing pressure and the growth of autocracies and dictatorships. We can look at what is happening in these months and these years now in the Sahel. And in the Asia-Pacific region, tension is rising. All this differs from the mood at the time of the celebration of the second millennium, just 23 years ago, when Francis Fukuyama spoke of the end of history following the end of the Cold War. Then democracy seemed to be on an onward march across the world. And even those countries which were not democracies were embracing capitalism with the expectation of all of us that democracy would somehow follow on. The democratic peace theory was paramount, and the whole notion of whether the market or the democracy came first or one led to the other, that was what governed our Western thinking. So today, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is more mixed. And my friends, I suspect there would be as many views about our broken world as there are people in the audience this afternoon. So let's just set that judgment aside for the moment. Each of you decide whether the world is more broken now than perhaps at a period in the past. But whether it is a broken world or not, or more or less broken than it was in previous centuries or decades, we still have to ask about the place of faith in this Australian context. Australia's system of government, like many Western countries which came out of the traditions of the British Empire, has the same contradictions as elsewhere. A public square that acknowledges the role of religious symbolism. Parliaments regularly pronounce the Lord's Prayer before commencing a sitting, and many swear oaths in judicial settings. Christian holidays still form the basis of our national calendar. But yet, we often ridicule those in public life who feel inspired or motivated by their faith, and regularly rail against churches expressing their perspectives on legislation coming before Houses of Parliament. What does this mean for our world, and how should one be as wise as a serpent or innocent as a dove in navigating a path through such a world? We can jump into the practical and deal with each situation as it arises, but that is simply tactical and eventually can leave us marooned in a place not of our choosing, in a destination we find strange. It can also result in faith itself not doing society a service by not asking society to focus on the difficult questions so that society itself does not intellectually drift. Questions for the broader Australian culture to ponder should focus on the place of faith in the wider society. Is it confined to this particular day? Is it a private belief that must not have any public dimension? Is it an individual freedom to worship that each of you enjoy as individuals, but without any collective dimension which is allowed to manifest itself in society? Does the society want to see a government system with a monopoly on health and education provision to the detriment of any other service provider? What, then, is the role of government when it comes to service provision? More crucially, perhaps, what is the very boundary or distinction we see or want between the state, the wider society, and the rights of individuals as both citizens and members of society, many of whom individually are also believers and also form the collective of the church? Over recent decades, ladies and gentlemen, the system in Australia has resembled a structure which encourages a multitude of providers to participate in delivering societal services and to be able to call on public funds to do so. Such a system, in my view, is born from a very healthy subsidiarity, which does not see power being delegated downwards, but rather power is being elevated upwards to the most effective level for optimal ends. It is a power that is owned at the individual and societal level rather than naturally resting with state or government. Yet there have been recent moves in Australia which could point to such an order coming undone or unravelling. The seizure of the Calvary Hospital in Canberra by the government of the ACT and the backing of the courts could be the first step in a worrying trend which sees faith groups or any other entity which claims a different type of identity pushed from providing a public good to wider society. That raises concerns, ladies and gentlemen, not just for particular faith groups affected, but for anyone wanting to provide a service and draw on public funds to do so. The move on Calvary also comes at a time when the debate on religious freedom has been ushered in on the back of the Australian Law Reform Commission. That raises complex issues on the rights of religious freedom and how those rights interact with other competing rights and which ones will triumph. Australia is not alone in such testing debates, as within Europe and in the US, the courts and broader society struggle to reach consensus. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, here in Australia, the decision by the government of Victoria to impose a payroll tax on non-government schools, many of them Catholic, despite strong protestation from Catholic education, seems to illustrate that in places there is an increasingly cold house for the wider collective mission of the Catholic Church in Australia. And what is that wider mission? In education, ladies and gentlemen, not including early years or tertiary, there are nearly 1,800 Catholic schools educating nearly 800,000 students in this country, thereby providing 20% of the provision across Australia. In health, it is equally compelling, with Catholic hospitals providing over 10,000 beds, split between 7,500 being in private hospitals and 2,700 in public Catholic hospitals. In the Catholic residential sector, over 25,000 beds are provided in residential and nursing homes. The Catholic healthcare sector is by far the largest non-government provider of health and aged care services in this country. So between health and education, nearly 200,000 staff are employed in those facilities. With such a huge sector making a valuable contribution, it is not a surprise, therefore, that the compulsory takeover of Calvary has led to bewilderment and, dare I say, a fear about the future. Up to now, Australia has been following a model which it shares with the UK and Ireland. But even in Ireland, the distinctive offering of Catholic healthcare and education is coming under pressure and threat. In recent years, the St Vincent's Group of Hospitals in Dublin has transitioned from the Catholic sector and patronage to having no religious affiliation. And in the higher education space, Catholic colleges in Southern Ireland have mostly been absorbed into larger secular entities. Therefore, when looking at Calvary, there is concern too about what is happening elsewhere. So how should the church and its members respond? How can we be alive to the words of caution in St. Matthew's Gospel, to be wise as serpents, innocent as doves, and what does that mean as a Catholic purpose for all of us? I believe, for a start, there has to be a sharp recognition of what is going on and the risks associated. We have to read the signs of the times and temper our approach and arguments accordingly. Complacency about what is happening, or thinking that it won't happen here, can only hasten the demise of a sector which makes a unique contribution. Equally, the norms and approaches of yesteryear, which won funding arrangements and accommodations following sometimes centuries of marginalisation or indeed persecution, are unlikely to survive intact. Nor is tradition or size a sufficient rationale for continued funding or the right to a separate existence. Why? Because we are once again in the midst of competing views about the future of our society, and much of that, ladies and gentlemen, revolves around the place of faith. Faith communities today have fewer friends and corridors of power than they once had. Arguments need to be reframed and debates refought for the age in which we live. And as societies secularise and the numbers of those identifying as religious decrease, more people will ask why taxpayers fund faith-based schools or faith-based entities, or why do we have hospitals with a religious ethos? Ladies and gentlemen, we need answers which respond to these questions, which are not new questions in and of themselves, but in many cases we have perhaps grown complacent about defending and promoting the cause within the broader society. Perhaps the hard-won battle to achieve funding and recognition, which required mass mobilisation and campaigning, has gone from our collective memory. We need, therefore, to reframe and to repeat answers for this age. It is unlikely, ladies and gentlemen, as I said, that the methods of yesteryear will prove effective in the years to come. It will likely need a broader coalition, which show the debate in a wider context and win over those who see the broader implications for a society that risks imposing a crushing uniformity if it erodes difference. But equally, it will need bolder mobilisation of individuals and groups who are equipped and prepared to engage in the democratic process and to leave no ambiguity about their desire to see a strong Catholic education and healthcare system, which is able to enjoy the freedom and support to operate effectively in society. Catholic education and Catholic healthcare is our gift to a broader society. It is not an optional choice for us as a church. The policy choices we make in our democracies will tell us something about the society we want to build and what role we want government to have. So this debate is not just about public subsidy for Catholic schools or hospital. It is deeper. It is a litmus test for broader freedoms within the society and the place of the individual vis-a-vis the government. Because faith communities help to reinforce democratic processes in liberal societies by ensuring that alternative perspectives are heard, groupthink is avoided, and a healthy check is maintained on government overreach or the risk of government overreach. Faith groups, like many other groups, form the backbone of our society. And that distinction between the state and society is crucial to maintain, but it is a difficult territory to navigate in determining our freedom. It always has, and it always will be. So to be wise in these times asks us to reach beyond the pew and to convince those beyond our immediate reach that a faith perspective helps to ensure the very plurality that keeps our public space liberal and open to challenge. As we built coalitions in the past, we can do so again by showing others who care about society that without challenge and difference, democratic nations run the risk of becoming illiberal, fostering uniformity which ultimately erodes some of our fundamental democratic values. What we are asked is to be wise and innocent, and to do so in balance. We want to show the place of faith in its broadest context, the pluralist approach, a system that will encourage greater participation by religious groups and other organisations, providing a public good, and therefore avoiding authoritarian tendencies, whether in our groups or within the broader society. As a result, ladies and gentlemen, this is not simply about public funding. It is about the very nature and structure of our society, or the one that we want to live in. If we want a society characterised by a lighter form of government, one acting as a regulator but open to a variety of providers, meeting acceptable standards and contributing to the flourishing of wider society and the people within that society, then we have to advocate for that, promote it, and never take it for granted. That is not an objective which is beyond the scope or outside the remit of the Catholic faith. It's not marginal to it, and it's not a choice. It is core to it, ladies and gentlemen. The Second Vatican Council said, "It is the task of the state to see to it that all citizens can come to a suitable share in culture and are properly prepared to exercise their civic duties and rights." That is a challenge that we face in each generation. For us today, we need therefore to ask afresh the question about the role of faith in our society and its contribution. If we think we don't, then perhaps others will provide the solutions for us that they have come up with, and we will sit on and watch in shock and awe. This system you have built up in Australia is part of your unique patrimony. It was a legacy from previous generations who built it from scratch and often on the margins of society and through the tireless work of many religious who never took a wage. Is it worth defending? Would your society be poorer without it? If your answer is yes, then the challenge to you is found in the words of Matthew's Gospel, and it is not words solely for bishops or religious. As citizens, as voters, they are words addressed to you too. We run a major danger if we do not know our own tradition well and the particular context that give birth to that tradition. Then we might do perhaps one of two things. We might think that the Calvary Hospital incident is a one-off until it is too late to stop a momentum. Or we might become complacent about the unique system of pluralism which is built up here and simply perhaps be attracted, like others, to follow an imported model of governance from another jurisdiction which does not have a healthy respect for the boundary between state and society and the freedoms that are caught within that distinction. The risk of our age, therefore, in my view, is one of drift, not of some programmatic, well-thought-out ideological movement. The risk that we have is one that can be susceptible to governments too, that of ideological drift. Governments with a good understanding of pluralism will be comfortable with the blurred edges between the role of the state and society, for such boundaries are never definitively settled, but are tested afresh in each age. However, if governments tend towards more absolutist public provision of services to the detriment of wider society, then it is unlikely that government-funded faith initiatives will survive in their current form, and a pluralist approach will gradually or suddenly disappear. So a state pays, so state rules approach could eventually lead to totalitarianism and upset the very inherent equilibrium in our society, which all democratic nations should strive for and protect. Hence, in the debate about the place of faith, there are some fundamental questions for faith groups, but also governments and every committed Democrat. The words of Matthew are as pertinent to a religious believer as they are to a citizen, even if the ends are slightly different. because for religious believer or democrat, there should be a shared striving for a belief that the purpose of government is to provide the opportunity for a good life for its citizens, not to define such a life or to extract resources from those citizens without representation and adequate checks and balances, nor to impose uniform beliefs. We should also strive for a common understanding, whether religious or not, that government can impose reasonable restrictions on the use of public funds, but it shouldn't use the threat of deprivation of those funds either as a matter of outright strangulation of unfashionable beliefs and groups, or to favour one part of the plurality over the other. So how can we be wise and innocent? We must engage, ladies and gentlemen, with the issues of the day. To do so innocently, it asks us not to do so simply to protect vested interest, simply because we have had the funding or the space over recent decades. Rather, it asks us to broaden the debate and illustrate why this issue is important to all and not just the few. That will serve society to keep it open, inclusive and rooted, and avoid the risk of an intellectual or complacent drift. To conclude, the Gospel asks us for balance, to be wise and innocent. So as with our individual temperament, then too with our societal temperament. We don't want to live in a theocracy, whether it be of the religious or secular bent. We want balance, a healthy balance that gives us the space as individuals, communities and societies to engage, to live and to flourish. We are tasked to show that faith in society is not the threat to a free society that some would have us believe, but that it helps to ensure vibrant pluralism where everyone thrives as individuals and communities. The threat to freedom, in my view, comes when our space is reduced and diminished, and where single authority tries to impose a one-size-fits-all on our ever more complex world. Today, in the context we are living in, I would advocate the following: to be both wise and innocent with a Catholic purpose. Do not retreat to the desert where it might be safe, and try to live with only the like-minded. Educate yourself and others about the context and what is under threat. Mobilise yourself and others and address the complacency, build coalitions and debate those you disagree with. Avoid groupthink at all costs. Engage as democratic citizens in the debate and use the free association to ensure the legacy handed on to you will also be there for future generations. Do so always with a belief in the goodness of the other, and that they, like St. Paul, can change their ways and see what you see, and that good can be done unto others and to you also through the encounter with them. In the words of Levinas, you too are likely to be changed in the encounter. Be open to that. Have faith and hope. The words of Matthew and of Jesus are not an invitation to apathy or resignation. But just think of those places in the world and think of the prayer of Newman, where you may not know your purpose in this world. It may be something that is revealed to you in the next world. Two places come to mind that remind us of faith and hope in the challenge of intolerance or government overreach. Two are found in Europe, and I think you would probably find many examples, perhaps closer to home. Two are abbeys. One is a Benedictine abbey of Buckfast in the southwest of England. It disappeared for 350 years out of its 1,000-year history, lost after the Reformation, but rebuilt by a group of monks who were exiled following the anti-clerical laws in France in the latter part of the 19th century. They didn't know that the site they had purchased used to be a monastery. It was only after 2 years that they discovered the foundations and rebuilt the church and the monastery brick by brick. So even if something is lost for 350 years, it can come again and it can give new flourishing. And then there is the Abbey of Septfonds in France. Today it is full. It has given rise to four other abbeys with the growth of the Cistercian community. But that community of monks three times has had to buy the abbey property back from the French state, and today it flourishes. So if there is anything that challenges our complacency or asks us to avoid an intellectual drift, is to think with a spirit of Christian hope that the challenges that we face are not new, the points raised are not new, the arguments used are not new. But we also, in the face of such adversity or such challenge, mustn't flinch from the task ahead. And even if we do not see success in our life, it may come in the lives of the community of believers who come after us. I leave you with this final image. And Jack laid down the challenge about saying something from my previous time in the Vatican, but as diplomats, we never like to speak about our diplomatic activity. And I think of an image that I witnessed from a side, just watching over, and an image that I thought I would never see. And that was the late Pope Benedict XVI on the afternoon of September the 17th, 2010, standing in Westminster Hall, which is the oldest structure in Britain, standing on the spot where St. Thomas More was condemned to death many centuries before. And there he was, addressing the joint Houses of Parliament, the House of Lords and the House of Commons, in front of all the former Prime Ministers of the United Kingdom. And from that image, and from the trial of St. Thomas, and from the time of the Reformation and the succeeding centuries, it shows what Christian hope can achieve and what rapprochement can achieve when the one talks to the other. So our invitation, ladies and gentlemen, to be as wise as serpents and innocent as doves with a Catholic purpose, I believe that picture of Benedict standing on the spot where St. Thomas More was condemned to death says something about Pope Benedict, it says something about history, and it says something about contemporary Western societies and the ability and strength for rapprochement and understanding. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Francis. What you said was in part a play against drift and in part a play against groupthink. Would you think that part of the harvest is that the Catholic Church has insisted on a form of groupthink in its history?
You're bringing me into controversial territory.
That's the Irish.
And the Irish will respond. I think there has been, if we look at the intellectual life of the church, if we look at the Second Vatican Council and we think of some of the real intellectual towers in the church and some of the thinking that was going on, and if we think in the post-war period or during the war period around the spirit of Christian democracy, around people sort of asking fundamental questions after the Second World War about where was Christ in the midst of this mayhem and this destruction and this human terror. And if we look at some of the political figures, De Gasperi, some of the people who founded the European Union, and then if we think of Jacques Maritain, and I'm asking myself the question, who contributed to a sort of a space now where either those thinkers do exist and they're not getting a hearing or we're not listening, but why were there fundamental contributions being made by Catholics, by Catholic intellectuals, which was feeding directly into the spirit of the church and where the church was theologically and in the society? And why was that, you know, why is that not now seen to be forming political discourse in a way that it did at that particular point in time? If I were to give you an answer, I would say that the Second World War and the horror of it shattered the complacency of the European continent and many parts of the West. So people, you know, that were during the war years that were in hiding or in isolation or, you know, saw the destruction of libraries and books and the intellect and saw this corruption of a society, went back to ask fundamental questions. But I think some of those fundamental observations, some of those fundamental questions, which were coming from the Christian tradition, have just seemed, we as a society seem to be just drifting. So we have some huge questions and huge issues to address, but it's as if the contribution that is coming from individual Christians or that Catholic intellectual tradition is not getting a hearing or is not landing. Why that is so, I don't know. Did the church as an institution crush the debate? I don't think it could. Maybe you might talk in sort of theology circles, but not in political science, not in philosophy. The question is, why is it not more alive in our academies? And, you know, why was, you know, that spirit of the late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, where you had, you know, that Catholic intellectual tradition breathing right into movements. So, for example, you know, addressing the issue of triumphant national sovereignty or supreme national sovereignty, you know, there's a huge body of thought and literature that shows that the origins of the thinking around the growth of the European community and the European Union has its origins in Catholic thought around German federalism from the 19th century, and then moves the whole way through. And why is that not happening today when we face some of these challenges? I don't know, but it's a brilliant question. But I don't think it's solely down to the reaction from the church. I think there's something else happening in our society, whether it's a gradual dumbing down, whether we are more materialistically satisfied and therefore more complacent about some of the fundamental issues.
Thank you very much. You alluded to, but didn't mention by name, two of my great modern heroes, Robert Schumann and Konrad Adenauer. Both of them were Catholic. Both of them were educated in pluralism, and both of them have changed the world for the better, in my view. Now, there must be other people who have questions or comments to make.
Thanks very much, Professor Campbell, for the fascinating address. There are so many questions that arise, aren't there? But perhaps on the question that Jack has raised, in terms of, well, what contribution is the church making now, and are there reasons why it's making less of a contribution than we might wish? And of a whole range of things one could mention, it seems to me the question of the role of women in the church, the place of women in the church, and a whole lot of issues surrounding that has had a great impact in terms of lessening the impact that the Catholic community can make in Australia. When we think of all the issues associated with Humanae Vitae and that whole development, where I think basically the prohibition of debate in many contexts was a factor. The refusal to advance the dialogue about women can be ordained as priests. Of course, we have the synod in Rome beginning soon, but in my experience at least, the distancing of many educated Catholic women who were brought up in very devout Catholic contexts, both in families and schools, and they are distancing from the faith community, distancing from a willingness to speak on behalf of the Catholic faith and tradition in the public forum. I think this is a very serious issue related to this whole question. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. So I think there is the intra and the extra. So intra-debate within the Catholic Church for issues around the role of women or the impact of papal encyclicals, etc., that's a very particular point. But I would say that if I look at the Anglican Church, if I look at the Lutheran Church, if I look at some of the more liberal Protestant denominations, they too have the same problem in impacting and forming views and debates within society. Religion or faith or a faith perspective or some of the fundamental philosophical or theological traditions that might impact a society, that might be pertinent to an issue that politicians in many countries are dealing with, it's just shut down and shut off. So why have we seen, you know, a period from, say, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and you could be right, it may be the case, if one broadens it out, that some intra-issues of how the church itself or churches formed or moved through the decades, that that has hastened a degree of irrelevance on the part of some policymakers. But I think I would argue that it's probably broader than that. So you mentioned Humanae Vitae, and I think it's fascinating when I look back at some of the studies that were coming out of the UN in the 60s and 70s that were coming with one particular approach around overpopulation. And you now look at the societies in Europe and in many parts of the West, and you look at China, which followed a particular trajectory that is now facing quite significant issues and challenges around its population replenishment. And many parts of the West, one has to look at Italy and Spain, which have huge fertility crises, which will have massive knock-on effects in relation to the economy. So if I were to come back just on that issue, I would say that it's about the balance I spoke about in our societies, which I think is the challenge of Matthew's Gospel and in the phrase we have this evening in front of us, so this afternoon. How is this balance? How does what UN population conferences we're talking about, how does that speak to Humanae Vitae or other such encyclicals or other such teaching from within the Christian churches? How is there an exchange of view? Because some of the things that the UN population conferences talked about in the 60s, 70s and 80s, the reverse has come to pass. So what is the challenge for some of the societies in Europe that are facing demographic time bombs? And it's in that midst that having a reasoned, intellectual, open debate. My fear is when we go into groupthink, when we go into sort of subsets of thought which cease to address the fundamental issue that is at hand, or when somebody sees a contribution from a Christian, a Catholic, or indeed from, you know, some representative of the church in the UN fora, before they speak, they have decided to shut it out. And I think in our approach and challenge here is, you know, how do we create a hearing for others, and how do we get a hearing? So if I look back at the funding arrangement here, for example, in Australia, I think it was Menzies who funded the Catholic schools. That's where the breakthrough came. It didn't require Menzies to be a Catholic. He wasn't a Catholic. But he listened to a perspective. He listened to a reasoned argument. And at the moment, there is a risk, I think, in polities where potentially the Catholic voice is perhaps listened to in one section of the polity but is automatically rejected in other sections of the polity. And perhaps inside, you know, for ourselves, we have a habit of doing that as well with social media. We look at a particular stream of social media that reinforces where we come from rather than necessarily challenges us to sort of think afresh. And I think there, whether it's the intra or the extra, I think that's where I would rest my comments, that I think if we looked intra, it's a separate set of questions around the internal intellectual life of the church, how theology is, and you will know more about this than I do, but how it's taught, how it's unpacked, how it is debated, how it influences church teaching, and how there is a development of doctrine in that Newmanesque dimension. But then for me, the bigger question as a political scientist is, how is it ambassadorial to the world? But if the world is not listening, then that raises fundamental questions for us. And we can't say that the world has moved on. The question is, why is it not listening? And it may be, as you suggest, it could be people looking at the intra. But I think if I broaden it out to the other groups who didn't have that teaching or didn't have that structure of church, they too are more marginal to national life. And I just would cite, you know, Anglicanism or Lutheranism. But you could also look in different parts of the world, you know, the state Lutheran churches in Northern Europe. It's a bit like what I said there. They're there often, you know, in a sort of the calendar and the prayer in Parliament and the external symbolism, but they're actually not, they're not core to decision making. People are not looking to it for ethical and moral guidance or an intellectual contribution. And in many parts of our world, the very expression of a religious, what somebody perceives to be a religious perspective, is automatically shut down as being irrational or lacking in reason. And that, for me, is the core challenge to us, is to basically bring back and make sure that that link between faith and reason is uppermost in every single thing that we do as an education community in the Catholic intellectual tradition. And it's complex, but I'm probably responding to you more as somebody who sat on the policy-making side and witnessed politicians interacting with church leaders or religious groups. And something has changed quite dramatically. And I could just give postscript to Jack. Adenauer, Schumann, yes, De Gasperi, all the, you know, the founding fathers of the European Union. And, you know, Schumann, De Gasperi, Spack, all people that came out of Christian democracy, all people that actually found, in many respects, a refuge and a home and an intellectual framework in the work of Jacques Maritain and in other Italian and German federalist thinkers. And I can think of, you know, in the 19th century, a lot of the Catholic thought process in southern Germany and in Italy that had a really, really healthy approach, firstly in Germany, to stop the sort of the Bismarck Prussian state from usurping power in a federal structure, and then in Italy as well about how to avoid sort of the, you know, fascist tendencies around state control or centralized state control and the use of subsidiarity and then tracing its origins back. And that's a perfect example of, you know, Catholic intellectual thought in the universities from political scientists and anthropologists bringing subsidiarity in the 30s into a papal encyclical, because it comes out of German federalist thought in southern Germany.
I speak quickly because I expect there's other questions, but I had 3 points. I think you're the most remarkable example I've heard in quite a few years in uni lectures of why there should be Catholic universities and why there should be someone like you at the helm. I, in any historical society which I go to, there's, without disrespect to anybody here, there's the almost inbuilt tendency to go down vast tributary channels. I'm suggesting, if I want to home right in on this, I feel like I've been hit in a praiseworthy way and punched in several times by the strength of your remarks. In particular, this Calvary business, if you can tell by my accent, as you can tell from yours, there isn't a great amount that, point one, that the U.S. can teach Australia. I think this is a more civilized society. However, just as you can have someone who lies through their teeth in the United States with a first name that starts with T, I don't think that's the problem. The problem is that vast numbers of people are indifferent to that being the case, and they don't call it out. So with this Calvary business, my parallel is, I am dumbfounded that this could happen, this question of Calvary Hospital being taken over. So I return to the example of North America. I do not understand, and I did not believe that could happen in the United States. Someone can just say, this Catholic institution I take over. Now here's another one and another one. So that was the first punch. The second one is that you said in Ireland that is even happening. So I return to point two now, and that is that does that mean we could wake up in 2024 in St. Vincent's, the whole network of maybe the best hospital system in the country is like an iceberg, global warming, Catholic institution warming, if I may say. So I'd like to you to say to us, do you know, in the case of hesitantly now in North America, I do not believe that sort of thing would happen, whereas if it even was attempted, there'd be a gigantic uproar in contrast to wonderful civilized Australia. And two, your remarks, I think that the copy should be sent to all these speakers, Paul Collins, ABC, Dr. Stephen McInerney, Sister Catherine Tom, that everybody, and that is this in the Catholic Weekly for a start, but that's a little group, is this in the Australian newspaper system, which is about 10,000 times more likely to reprint it than the Fairfax paper, surely we know that. And three, these remarks that you made, 233, Catholic education and healthcare is our gift to society. If you ask the people at your uni or in the Catholic school system, did you know there's 1,800 schools, that there's 10,000 beds, that there's 25,000 nursing? I would think the answer is they don't know that. And then you mentioned 239, we're sitting and watching and in shock and awe. And then 243, this final nugget. There were so many nuggets that were so punchy in your speech, using of funds as a matter of strangulation. I'd like to think that everybody here, whoever you know in any context, that whatever what you've said today has to get out there. So I close with that by saying, can you, in specific terms, tell us, is there a chance that specifically the great St. Vincent Network could, again, global warming, I'm using the example, the Catholic institutional iceberg melts. And more specifically, isn't it true that, as far as I know, that in the United States, with its countless flaws, I don't think that can happen without a tidal wave of reaction? And thank you. It's just brilliant what you've said.
Thank you, Grant. Well, Grant, let me respond. There's a number of points you raise. Let me respond first and foremost by saying I'm a guest in Australia. So I'm not Australian, and so what I will temper my views. I'll be careful about. I know in a Northern Irish context, what unites both communities is somebody from the outside telling us what to do. So I'm not going to make that mistake here. I'm highlighting, I think, what is an issue. So Calvary has happened. Calvary went to the courts, and the courts upheld. And Calvary is a public hospital, was a public hospital, public Catholic hospital. So the distinction with the United States, you have a very strict separation of church and state. It's slightly different from the French separation of church and state. Within the what I would describe as the British sphere of common law, and there are many lawyers and barristers in the room, so I'm going to be very, very careful in what I say here because that's not my remit. It's not my expertise. You have a debate in the United States about public subsidy. So there is not, to my knowledge, a public Catholic hospital in the United States. Nor is there a public Catholic university, nor is there a public Catholic school, that the parochial authorities have their own schools. Parents need to pay the tuition, and they don't get state support to do so. In Australia, it's coming more out of the English tradition, And that allows for the Catholic Church to be active in the state, providing a service. Now, last year, I outlined why that was so. I remember dealing with the French, Spanish and Italian press when Pope Benedict was coming to the United Kingdom on a state visit. And they kept talking about, some of them kept saying, but, you know, the United Kingdom is anti-Catholic. And as Her Majesty's ambassador at the time, I had to say, well, what do you mean by that? Describe to me what an anti-Catholic state would look like. For example, would it be one where Catholic parents would have to pay the tuition to go to Catholic schools? Because in Italy, in France and in Spain, Catholic schools do not get public subvention, whereas in Britain and the Netherlands, they have two of the most generous funding arrangements that you will find anywhere in the world. Now, in the British context or in the UK context, that enlightenment comes from trying to eradicate and suppress difference. So if I look at the school that I went to or the schools that I went to, they all emerged in the years and months following the passage of the Roman Catholic Relief Act of 1829. So for roughly 300 or just shy of 300 years, as a legal and political instrument, within England and within the broader context, it was different with different legal jurisdictions, but all coming under the Crown at that time in Ireland, Scotland, and England and Wales. But there was different applications of the penal legislation. And the penal legislation tried to eradicate difference. It tried to impose uniformity, whether on Catholics or on the Anabaptists or the Presbyterians. It was an attempt to have a single national church and to marginalise and eradicate difference. So I would argue, in the context in which I am from, as a defence of public subsidy for Catholic schools, that public subsidy comes from nearly three centuries of penal repression, where my forebears did not have rights, land was seized, they survived in mountainous areas, and the awakening that happened in the 19th century is one that we have today. The schools can trace their origins. The funding didn't come really until, you know, moves in the 19th, differed in England and Scotland and Ireland, Northern Ireland, but it didn't come until the 20th century. And indeed, full funding didn't come in my jurisdiction until my own lifetime. So that's there as to why I would say things are as they are. And the US debate, the Australian debate, is more closely related to Ireland. As regards St. Vincent's here, I think, again, there's a fundamental difference. And I say this, and I've said this before in other fora, the laity in Australia are in a much stronger position. You have a thing called PJPs, of which Notre Dame was the first public juridic person. So the religious orders recognised, read the signs of the times, looked at a declining vocations rate, and when they were in a position of strength, they set up public juridic persons and they passed the leadership of their missions over to lay people, to lay Catholics, to take forward. That has not happened in Ireland, and it is only now happening in the United States. So the risk is that when you no longer have the religious to run the institution falls over. So it's a domino effect. Whereas here in Australia, you have a strength of numbers. So you have peak bodies like Catholic Healthcare Australia, you have the National Catholic Education Commission, and then you have the PJPs following the different charisms of the different orders. But it even goes further than that. This is, you know, it's remarkable how bold and prophetic this is. But I attended last year's Catholic Healthcare Association meeting in Brisbane, and the chair of I think it was St. Vincent's, and either Matter or Mercy, because I keep the Mercy Order together, so I don't know whether it was Matter or Mercy, but the two of them spoke, and the challenge they laid down to Catholic Healthcare Australia, to the five sort of PJP hospital groups, was, is it time for us to come together to form one group? And I thought that was really bold and prophetic. I looked out and in the audience, and I probably thought that the ones who would be opposed to this the most would be the sisters who had built up the individuals and had the connection to Mary Aikenhead or Catherine McCauley as founders. But actually, two of the first interventions from the floor, one was from a religious sister of charity and one was from a Mercy sister, basically saying, go for it. That try and think about how you would create a single Catholic healthcare network, because the risk even now in the size and the complexity is that one group, you know, today we're talking about Calvary, but what if it was an entire hospital group that was taken? So I think it's Australia's in a stronger position than in Ireland. I think within Ireland there are distinctions. So perhaps I've always felt that in the south of Ireland, perhaps you're dealing with a very homogeneous Catholic society where the church and the state had become too intertwined. North of the border, that did not happen. So I have no expectation of the state being benign. I'm always on guard. I will always have a healthy suspicion, and I will always not be complacent about the risk of a state encroaching upon my civil liberties. But the same is true also in relation to, you know, what is the role of the church? And if I finish my comment to you on this around, why do I see a value in retaining something that I think in time of crisis can provide profound meaning? And it's no accident, I think, that the people who rebuilt Europe and gave us the architecture of the European Union, from within the context of the Second World War, never gave up hope, inspired by Christian democracy or Christian socialism. And I would say that if I think of my own life, and I think of the challenge in Catholic schools that I went to, where the church and the church leaders, teachers, lay people, clerics, sisters, each day of the school day engaged in a constant dialogue with us as children about the sanctity of human life, which contrasted with what was going on outside the school window. So if that wasn't there, then I think I and many others would have found ourselves complacently drifting towards louder voices that would have offered an alternative solution, which would not have been a solution, which would not have adhered to Christian teaching or basic moral teaching about the sanctity of human life and the taking of human life. So for me, that in a sense tested Catholic education in the furnace for me. So that's why I think it's a system that if it wasn't there, when we reach a crisis, and history tells us we will always reach a crisis, we need something that is immovable, something that checks our own instinct to drift emotionally or in a reactionary way, and in a sense gives us an intellectual cold shower. And I saw many church leaders who'd never put popularity at the forefront but actually came in to tell us under quite a lot of pressure what the right thing to do was on the basis of wisdom and insight coming from the Christian tradition. So I've come a roundabout way to give you an answer, but I hope I've given you an answer.
Thank you very much, Professor, for the observation, particularly about the church working together and a unified approach to these delicacies of the relationship between church and state. Healthcare is particularly difficult and complex. The Calvary Canberra situation, I'll come back and comment about in a moment, but people will remember when government policy rationalised Catholic hospitals in New South Wales. We no longer have the Mater General Hospital in Crow's Nest. We no longer have Lewisham Hospital. We no longer have St Margaret's Public Hospital. And when the state government offered the Sisters of St Joseph a relocation of St Margaret's Public Hospital, Maternity Hospital, from Darlinghurst, which was over-serviced, to the southwest of Sydney that was underserviced, the Sisters of St Joseph said no. They were given moral theology advice that I think was deeply flawed, so I'm not making any judgment or blaming the sisters in any way. They acted on the advice that they had. But then we need to remember that the government did go into a partnership with the church, with the public juridic person of Catholic healthcare at the Hawkesbury Hospital. When we look at the example of Calvary Canberra, remember it's a public hospital, fully public funded, it's just worth remembering that 10 years ago the board of that hospital wanted to sell its hospital back to the government. And the board at the time, Tom Brennan was the chairman, that's the brother of Father Frank Brennan, who's well known to us. They thought that their best way of promoting Catholic healthcare in the ACT was to sell back the public hospital and then provide healthcare in other ways. Now, that created a furore in Canberra at the time. People didn't like it. The Archbishop, Mark Coleridge, intervened. And the whole deal that was almost on the cusp of being signed fell over. So it's just worth putting that perspective on what's gone on now, which is the reverse. And I think, again, it's hard. I know I've got no knowledge at all of the intricacies of the relationship, but just if you just contemplate the government investing many hundreds of millions of dollars in a new hospital, replace Calvary with Ramsay Healthcare, and think about the taxpayers' reaction of the government giving money to a private institution. So there's issues here about this that I think we have to keep in perspective, but also I think the weakness in the whole business is that, personal view only, there's a certain timidity in church leadership, I think, at the moment, that hasn't invested in establishing the relationships at the political level to head off these issues before they get played out on the front page of the papers.
So I think, Father Brian, I think your points about Calvary, and I'm aware of the past sort of debates within the board, and in fact, it's a reminder as well, you know, in Ireland, the St Vincent's Group, which is much larger than one hospital in Calvary, it's the largest hospital in Dublin, it wasn't the state that took St Vincent's. It wasn't the state that insisted that the new trust have no reference to religion or God. The sisters gave it. And I think, you know, they were getting criticism in the media around the maternity hospital and the new maternity hospital. And this is why sometimes I think in the face of adversity, we can step back, we can hide. And so I think Calvary, I think your point around timidity is really interesting. And it perhaps is another way of saying that as a community, can you replace timidity with complacency? Is it one of the same thing? But is the challenge for church leaders, and then who are church leaders? But, you know, the bishops have a very particular challenge on the back of the abuse crisis. So perhaps in the past, that public square was sort of left too much to episcopal leadership. So where is the space now for lay people to be stepping into this fora and to be challenging and to be doing the work on this? So I think the timidity is probably something that we all share in. But I do think that you are right to say, and I think this is where it goes back to a little bit about Grant's question. The issue of Calvary is very complex because it's that space that is public where the church is doing a public good and where it's public funded. The private space is less complex, but could become complex in due course. But the tradition in Australia, the tradition, I would say, coming out of your origins, out of a part of the British Empire, is that you have been able to call on public subsidy to do a public good. If that's removed, you're going more down an American or French route. Go down that route with your eyes open, but it's not your philosophical enlightenment. It's a completely different tradition. And as a Catholic, I think what we do in terms of the service of education or the service of hospitals, we are ambassadors for the church to wider society. It's a gift. Could we do that gift if we weren't able to enjoy public subsidy? With great difficulty. So for me, it's something about the individual, and it's something about my choice as an individual in a community, and it's something about a proper distinction between the power and limits of the state, and I'm using state here as in government, not in the federated sense, and society, which is broader. So if I were French, having to be French to the detriment of everything else, I don't think I could do that. Because, you know, in the way it was, and I think still is, in the British UK system, I can be Catholic and Irish. I can have a British passport and an Irish passport. The multiple parts of identity that form our citizenship are now allowed. But that has come from painful experience where we didn't allow it. So the Calvaries of this world are sort of little stops along the way that sort of illustrate to us some of the deeper questions that are at play in our society. And I think we just have to always be cognizant of that, because there's a risk that if we just take them one by one, and I think this is where you're fundamentally right, 10 years ago to now, and then where will this lead to in 10 years' time, then we can find ourselves intellectually marooned and basically without a system. And what you say about St. Joseph's, I wasn't aware of that hospital issue. But again, it's around strategy and foresight, and I would hope that the PJPs, which I think, you know, Australia is at the forefront of, you've had PJPs here for 30 years, I never heard of a PJP until I came to Australia. So it's only now that they're taking off in Ireland and in Britain and the United States, and I think it's a wonderful gift the Australian Church has given to society.
Thank you, Chris Worthington. Just a question. There's no doubt that the takeover of Calvary was because they wouldn't take part in abortion or euthanasia. Now that those two things are legal in New South Wales, do you have any concern about laws being passed that may say, well, righto, if you don't take part in this, well, then we take over the hospital? So what I'm worried about is legislation that could say that or be implemented, and that's the concern I've got.
So, Chris, yes, I do have a concern about that. It's a question, though, of how do we get to that position, and what level of openness or engagement is there? So up to maybe 20 years ago, broadly again coming out of, and forgive me for sort of bringing this back to the sort of an Anglosphere, broadly we allowed for conscientious objection. And there's elements of this in the Australian Law Reform Commission's ideas around religious freedom. Do you have the freedom to conscientiously object? And does that trump somebody else's right? And that's a debate that's ongoing. The United Kingdom, when transposing EU anti-discrimination legislation in the early years of the millennium, probably around 2002 to 2003, was faced with an issue around, I think it might have been Article 13 or 113. My memory isn't as good as it used to be. Was faced with a challenge from a bit like the religious discrimination challenge that's going on at the moment in Australia, around what sort of exemption would be given for religious groups. And it focused on the adoption agencies, the Catholic adoption agencies. And a law was passed which allowed for no exemption. So the Catholic adoption agencies were faced with the choice of either acquiescing to the anti-discrimination law, which they couldn't do because of the ethos and the identity. And this was around placing children into same-sex marriages or relationships. So basically, the Catholic adoption agencies in England had to close. They either had to secularise or close. Scotland, they took a case, and I think that's still going through. I don't know how their judgment worked on it, but again, the risk here is that if we don't allow space for conscientious objection, then you basically are pushing religious groups or difference out. So can somebody get voluntary assisted dying at a health facility somewhere in Australia, in New South Wales, or can they access abortion? And in the past, the public policy in different jurisdictions allowed for, well, that's a Catholic hospital, that doesn't do that. But actually, that service is provided over there. If the drift here is towards the state is paying, so therefore the state is allowing no exemption, then it's impossible for that mission of the church, in my view, to continue whilst being faithful to its ethos. There's a loss of a pragmatic accommodation. And up to now, we've had a pragmatic accommodation. And again, I think it comes back to how are we engaging and how are we listening to the other? I don't think policymakers set out to try to push difference out. But I think perhaps the dialogue that was there before is perhaps not getting the same hearing as it has in the past. The question is, how do we engage? How do we ensure a healthy plurality? And, you know, how can you look and think, would our societies be all the poorer if Catholic healthcare was not part of that provision? And my answer to that would be yes, and the same in education. But that requires a degree of pragmatic accommodation. So the state is allowed to impose reasonable standards. The question is, what's reasonable? And that requires a dialogue back and forward and a healthy dialogue. But if you're reaching the point where you're being asked to do something that is fundamentally against your conscience, I come back to the image I concluded my speech with. Look at Benedict's speech from 2010 on the spot where Thomas More was condemned to death. These issues are not new. They're not new. So I hope that gives you an answer.
Jack?
With that phrase, pragmatic accommodation, Francis has encapsulated the entire problem of challenge of his talk. That is the tolerance of difference, the celebration of difference, balanced against uniformity and cohesiveness. W.B. Yeats talked about the centre cannot hold. When that very phrase presupposes that there's a periphery as well that needs to be held in. So centre and periphery cannot remain at odds for all that they serve different functions. So thank you very much indeed. Francis has given us a talk which celebrates difference, but recognises its challenges at the same time, and long may that tension exist in our society and our lives. Thank you very much indeed.
We've been listening to Professor Francis Campbell, Vice-Chancellor, University of Notre Dame, Australia, speaking at the September 2023 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society on Navigating a Broken World with a Catholic Purpose, Wisely as Serpents, Innocently as Doves. Dr. John Carmody moderated the Q&A. ACHS meetings are held at 2 p.m. on the third Sunday of each month, from February to November, in the Crypt of St. Patrick's Churchill, 20 Grosvenor Street, The Rocks, Sydney. Please go to the ACHS website for details of our full program of talks. On Sunday the 15th of October 2023 at St. Pat's, our speaker will be Dr. Peter Kunich, who's the historian of St. John's College at the University of Sydney, which is on its way to a history. You're most welcome to join us. Each ACHS talk is recorded on Gadigal lands, and its podcast is produced on Wallametagal lands by me, John Kenny. The Society acknowledges the traditional custodians of the places upon which we record and make the podcast, or in which our stream may be heard. Goodbye for now, but please go safely.